Timothy J. Smith, I'm glad to welcome you back to Queer Writers of Crime. And before we get going, I've got to say something about your novels. You've had four novels, and two of them are currently in publication and are readily available pretty much everywhere. One is The Fourth Courier, and then your most recent novel is Fire on the Island. Then Cooper's Promise, which I believe was your second novel?
It's the second novel I wrote, but as I recall, it's the first published.
Okay, but that's okay. Cooper's Promise isn't available on Amazon or any of those, but I did find it for sale all over the net, so there are places to buy it.
Right, there are.
A Vision of Angels is a whole different story.
I know.
I wanted to find it, and I searched and searched, and I came out, I couldn't find it, but I found it in one place, and it's an online site called Abe's Books. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I do know that site, yeah.
They have a lot of older books. Now, the condition of that book, they said, was acceptable. It had heavy wear and water stain. I want you to guess what that book was listed for. What price?
$30?
Well, Cooper's Promise ran anywhere from $4 to $16. On Abe's book, A Vision of Angels cost $249.99. And to add insult to injury, shipping was an extra $4.
Yeah, okay.
They couldn't roll that into the price.
Yeah, right.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shree.
This is Brad, and this is Queer Writers of Crime. And if you don't remember from a minute ago, my guest today is Timothy J. Smith. This is the second time you've been on. And I can tell you the last words I said when you were on before was, I can't believe we have to stop now because I can go on for hours. I don't know if we're going to finish up. That'll be pretty hard to do, but we'll get as much in as we can.
Okay.
Because I know there's going to be plenty to talk about. You are a fascinating man, as you well know. Now, normally I don't do long interviews anymore, just real quick ones, but it's really hard with you to avoid not doing one. So I'm going to try and give a Reader's Digest version.
Okay. And I appreciate the compliment. Thank you.
So here it goes. Timothy has won numerous awards for his four novels, including a nomination for a Lambda Literary Award for his book, The Fourth Courier. His most recent novel, Fire on the Island, has gotten rave reviews. He's been interested in social issues since the 60s with civil rights. He became actively involved in the 70s with most of his focus on poverty, which he wound up working in 33 countries during that time period. People he's encountered in his thrilling life, which is more thrilling than his thrillers, if that's possible. In your words, you said you've encountered Polish cops, Greek firemen, or fishermen, I'm sorry, mercenaries, arms dealers, child prostitutes, wannabe terrorists,
yeah.
Indian chiefs, and Indian tailors. And you hung with all of them in unparalleled international career. And in all of that, in your career, you smuggled banned plays from behind the Iron Curtain, maneuvered through occupied territories. You represent the U.S. at the highest level of federal governments. And one of my favorite stories is you stowed away aboard a devil's barge for a three-day crossing from Camp Verde. And I believe when you reached the final point, you wound up in jail.
Right.
So they caught you. You know what? That makes your story that much interesting.
I will tell you that in Cooper's Promise, that crossing, actually, not so much that crossing, but Cabo Verde or Cape Verde. I spent a couple of weeks there. I was really stranded, literally stranded. And that is a setting of Cooper's Promise. is basically a brothel, bar in that I hung out in, because that was the only place to get a drink in the whole place. And it was, and when I did get to Senegal on this barge, I was actually arrested. Yeah, all that's true. I don't make things up. They just happened to me.
Do you look back and say, how the hell am I still alive?
Yes, I do. I seriously do. And I put myself in dangerous situations, not necessarily knowingly, but I was just young and brash and ready to do anything. But in fact, when I was arrested in Senegal, I was put under boat arrest and I was taken back to the barge, which was going to spend about 3 days docked in Dakar, Senegal, and then spent 8 days crossing to Puerto Rico. And when the police handed my passport to the captain of the boat, the only thing he said to me was, I knew you were trouble. And I knew that I was not ever going to be seen again if I stayed on that barge. We'd be a day out to sea and overboard I'd go. There was no question in my mind about that. So I was prepared to jump into the water that night and swim away and try to find my way ashore and somehow survive. And we were at a dock, but I couldn't get off of the boat. I was blocked. So I would have to jump into the bay or the harbor and try to do it. It was a very scary time in a sense, but I was only in my early 20s. So, you know, how scared can you be? You don't know.
I've been pretty scared in my 20s.
But it's a true story.
How long were you trapped, basically held prisoner on that boat?
The issue was I was arrested upon arrival in the country because I did not have an exit ticket. And So I tried to convince the police that all they had to do was take me to an airline's office. I had a credit card and I'd be able to buy an exit ticket. But what they didn't realize was that I knew nothing about bribery. I had never even considered bribing them. And that's all they wanted. So the whole conversation that I have in the novel at the time of my arrest is and what happened to me is actually verbatim. It was an interesting situation. Yes, I do wonder how I managed to survive several situations that I found myself in, but that was probably truly the closest to being able to be disappeared without anybody having any idea where I was.
So you were basically waiting to die.
Yeah. Well, what I was doing was calling out to anybody who passed the boat and telling them my name, telling them I called the American Embassy, you know, this sort of thing. And somebody along the way in that course, from midday into the evening that this happened, basically, the real chief of police showed up. I gave him all the money I had, which wasn't very much, and he was able to basically go buy me an airplane ticket out of the country, and he let me in the country, and I had 50 cents in my pocket. That was it. And this is before their ATM machines or anything like that. So I had $4.50, excuse me, in my pocket. I remember exactly. So anyway, that's a long time ago.
Well, what's interesting from our last conversation and having read some things online, you're getting free, like in this case, has been as big of an adventure as getting in trouble. It was like luck fell into your lap almost.
Yeah, I never actually think of myself as particularly lucky. I think of myself as I try very hard to make things happen. So whether I want to go off and have some fun or whether I want to get out of being arrested or thrown into the sea, I work very hard at that.
If you want to hear juicier stories about Timothy's life, go back to episode 67, which was in January of 2021. We get really in depth in some of the things we're talking about, and we're not even scratching the surface here. But one thing I didn't ask you then that I find interesting is you worked in 33 countries, and most of that you were working in government jobs, or at least for somebody. It wasn't part of your just random adventures.
No.
So I'm curious, for those 33 countries, what was your air quote job?
I always worked as an independent contractor in international development, or before that in domestic development. I started my career during the war on poverty, which would have been in the Jimmy Carter's era. I worked with Jimmy Carter's White House on some very important issues. Then I flipped into international work, and I had some areas of expertise. I am a finance expert in terms of development projects. I can do the financial analysis and come up with the budgets and all that and show how, what's sustainable and what's not. I developed a specialization in housing finance, which sounds really boring to most people. But my job that was really incredible in housing finance was that ultimately I was a World Bank advisor to the first minister of finance of the Solidarity government in Poland for 2 years. And my job was to introduce a mortgage finance system to Poland for the first time in Polish history, which means that people could go to a bank and borrow money to buy a house as opposed to simply saving it. So they could buy more than 20 square meters. They could buy 100 square meters, that kind of thing.
That must have been incredible to watch.
It was incredible to watch. In fact, now I looked it up the other day, but not the other day, a couple months ago for some reason. Over 80% of all real estate transactions in Poland now involve a mortgage, now involve financing from the bank. And that was not available at all when I was there. That's why I was doing it.
Yeah.
So, and that led me into some microfinance stuff. I also helped set up the National Consumer Cooperative Bank in the States, which was the first cooperative bank to ever be established, and it's now out of existence, but not because of me. It just didn't do the right thing. You know, I had some amazing experiences because I really wanted to do these things that helped other people, but I wanted to make a career out of it at the same time, and I proved all the naysayers wrong that you couldn't do that. You couldn't be helping poor people and still actually make a decent living. You can. I mean, in the sense that there are opportunities out there. There's professional opportunities where you're really doing some good work. So that's what I did in these countries.
Well, it's interesting to me that you were somewhat of a number cruncher and became an author. And I know a lot of DJs that math really helped them just because they're listening to the beats and that sort of thing, and they know when to mix. So it's a little bit different that you chose to be a writer. But you're not the first person I talked to that I've had people that were full-time accountants that have been on the show and turned out to be great writers. So I guess we can all start somewhere. But I don't know the time. It's been kind of nebulous that I was able to figure out, but I'm thinking in the 50 to 20-year-ish after starting this career, your careers, you finally decided to settle down and write?
I guess I started my career when I finished graduate school. I got a very, very good job right out of it. That would have been 76, I guess. And then I decided to turn to full-time writing in 1997. I guess that's about a 20-plus year run. That
it's almost 25.
It was very intense work the whole time. I mean, actually, my first job out of undergraduate work was in Greece for a couple of years, which was a fascinating experience. And I came back to do graduate work. And my first job after that, at getting out of college, was to write the definitive legislative background analysis of redlining that led to the Community Reinvestment Act. I mean, it was just an incredible experience to do that at such a young age. But I had written a master's thesis on it, and I got picked up by an organization that had received the contract to do the definitive piece on redlining. And they heard about my dissertation, my master's dissertation, and hired me on the spot. And that led me amazingly into 10 years at least of work in the U.S. where I had, it's almost unbelievable to think about it, but I had access to the White House. I was working with somebody on the White House Domestic Policy Council, and I could literally show up in Washington and show up at the old executive office building and say, I'm here to see so-and-so, and I would be let in. I didn't have to have clearance or anything. I just had to show ID, and she wanted to see me. She was, we were working on some projects. So it was, I lived through a time of exceptional access, and I took advantage of it so I could do these things.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. Who knows? Brad may just read yours on the air.
So now, you kind of had this crazy life, and then you did something even crazier. You said, I'm going to write. And when you decided to write full-time and the world around you found out, you were warned against writing gay protagonists.
Right.
You were told that you'd become a gay writer, again in air quotes, and you probably after that wouldn't be able to go mainstream.
Right.
Obviously, you didn't listen to them, but at any time during those conversations, did you seriously give thought to what you were being told?
I did, to the extent that I wanted to be certain that I was not writing erotic gay stuff, and I never really intended to. It's not what I'm interested in reading, and it's just not who I am. So, but I did. I thought about it, and I thought, well, but I see the world through the eyes of a gay man, and a professional man, not just somebody who just is gay and's out there, but somebody who's seen the world and knows that it can be different. For gay people don't have to always be in the closet. I was. In some of the situations overseas, I was able to be out, and some I wasn't able to be out. It was just a matter of the country and the culture and the particular situation.
You once said that you didn't set out to write gay characters, and it just happened. And I got to say, that kind of happened to me only because it was never even a thought. I just knew I was going to write gay characters. I didn't know. It's just what my hands wanted to write. And like you, I thought it was all romance and erotica.
Right.
So do you think, given that you could sit down and write a good mainstream, and I hate the word mainstream, but a good mainstream novel?
I have. Yeah. I mean, Fire in the Island is loved by everybody who reads it. It's a mainstream novel. It just happens to have a gay lead. And all my books have main gay characters, or in one case, The Fourth Courier, it's a story where a white, straight FBI agent and a black, gay CIA agent team up to investigate an event that's happened in Poland. These aren't stories that are intended to be just for a gay audience. They're mainstream. They're FBI agents. They're CIA agents. What else? I've got a journalist in one of my novels. I'm trying to think of what the fourth one is. The one I'm writing about right now is a story of a young gay Syrian refugee in Istanbul, who's just basically trying to keep safe and survive the war that he's a refugee from. But it's a very contemporary story that I think is going to do very well because, there's one side where a white gay male is sort of like not trendy anymore. And, I'm fighting that battle too. Is like, but these are interesting characters. They're doing good stuff. They're interesting. So I think I'll be fine on that. But yeah, I mean, I've thought about at the time that I started writing, I thought through those comments that people made, and I thought, no, I just see the world differently. I see the world as being able to be gay professionals doing their jobs and being accepted in that.
And they've been doing it a long time. People just didn't know it.
Yeah, they have. Yeah.
So right. You were listing off the different jobs your characters have had. And I think the one you missed, one of them was an army sharpshooter.
Yeah, that's Cooper's. Yep. Yeah, right.
And then you had a war journalist and two FBI agents that I'm aware of.
Right, two FBI agents, yeah.
What I love that I've heard from you is that you write each novel where the protagonist just happens to be gay, but being gay was integral to the story. How so? Like in a thriller novel, how do you make the gay character not just an FBI agent who just happens to be gay? How do you make a thriller with an FBI agent where being gay is important to the story?
In fact, every one of my novels, the story ultimately turns on the fact that the main character is gay, and it creates a situation which is a serious turning point in the story. And I don't want to really give much away, but
of course not.
It's just would this same situation happen between two straight people? No, it wouldn't happen the same way. We have our own subculture. We do things differently than the straight world in certain situations. I mean, the whole notion of just. Whatever. I don't want to give anything away, but The Fourth Courier is a good example where the whole homosexual element to it just crushes the antagonist in the novel in a way that it couldn't have happened if he were straight. Or so he's a second gay character in the novel. He's not the CIA agent. He's somebody else. All of my books have a turning point that's unique to the gay subculture, but is also mainstream at the same time. Don't know else how to say it.
Well, and I want to go back to my earlier question and word it differently, because you are correct. Your novels are mainstream. They're great thrillers, very well written, very, very well written. So it would attract a mainstream audience. No surprise. I know most of your books have been thrillers. Fire on the Island is a thriller. It's a little softer of a thriller. There's not action-packed explosives, that sort of thing. You're not watching a Jason Bourne film, but it's still a thriller. Given that, do you think that writing thrillers with a gay protagonist are more difficult than it may be in some of the other crime genres?
No, I don't. And I also, it's really hard for me where to really place my work, whether it's a thriller shelf or whether it's something else, because they're literary. What I try to do is, first of all, my whole career was in doing social justice and economic justice and that sort of stuff. So I have a social consciousness, and there's certain issues that I decide I want to write about. Cooper's Promise is about human trafficking, and the book I'm currently working on is about the refugee crisis in Turkey, basically. I don't really write traditional thrillers, and to call them literary thrillers is what was popular for a while, but then bookstores kept saying, well, we don't really know what shelf to put this on. Is it the thriller shelf or is it the literary shelf? Okay, so basically we ended up on the thriller shelf because it seemed like that was more realistic. The last book, Fire on the Island, my publicist called it, or publisher called it, a romantic thriller, which I thought was great because it kind of softened the edge on the thriller, but it still made it kind of suspenseful. I want to say a couple of things. You're right that there's an FBI agent in The Fourth Courier and who helps investigate this particular crime that happens there in Poland. I think I have two FBI agents that I've written about. A lot of people really criticize me for that, and they say, what the hell is an FBI agent doing in an investigation in Poland? Well, the FBI has FBI agents in 60 countries around the world, and those countries that receive them are really having a hard time with refugee issues, arms dealing, human trafficking, or drug dealing. And so I've met with FBI agents in three of the countries to talk about what they do. So that's a realistic thing. And the fact that you mentioned that they were FBI agents, I just kind of want to clarify why they happen to be in my international stories, is that they exist.
It's good that you clarified that, because I do think most people think FBI agents stayed within U.S. boundaries and everything else is the CIA.
Nope. FBI does crime. CIA does intelligence.
Exactly.
And so if they're in the same country, one's working on counterparts in the police forces and that sort of thing, and one's working on counterparts in whatever their CIA is.
What draws you to thrillers?
I write books that I like to read. So I like reading really interesting, character-driven, suspenseful books. So that's what I do, and that's what I write. Oh, I was going to say my process is that I decide, okay, so what do I want to write about next? Is it human trafficking? There's a whole story why I even wrote a book about human trafficking, which is an interesting story, but I won't go into that, but unless you ask me.
I do want to get to that later, because human trafficking is so repulsive to me, and I know you wrote a book on it. So I do want to get that eventually. We're going to make sure.
Okay. Yeah, my process is I want to illuminate something to my readers that they don't maybe know much about, like human trafficking or what life was like for the average Polish family at the end of the Cold War when Solidarity came into power or something like that. And then I think, okay, so if I'm going to write about human trafficking, what's my suspenseful plot? What's really going to drive this plot-wise? And then, okay, so then what kind of characters do I need? And so that's how I come up with my characters. I say, well, if I've got a human trafficking situation where a young girl is going to be sold into prostitution, I've got to have somebody who's going to be able to be in a position to kind of help her or something like that. And what kind of story am I really telling? So that's the process I go through. I first decide on sort of the subject matter and where to best place that and what kind of characters I need to tell the kind of story that I eventually work out. And these are the kind of books I like to read. I like to read books set in foreign locations that are just suspenseful and full of good characters.
And I find this is the second time that you mentioned the characters, and it really interests me because your stories are character driven. You do get into social issues. course, you have gay characters. And I don't think of those in a thriller. Thrillers generally, and I'm speaking generally speaking, obviously, but generally a picture is a thin character, and it's all about the action.
Right, exactly.
And I can't think of a book off the top of my head, but so I'll use Jason Bourne because it's a very easy one to do.
Right.
We don't know anything about Jason Bourne. Of course, he doesn't either, but you don't care. It's all about him running. And that is typical of what you see in thriller with very little character development. And you do both.
Right. What would you call it, what I do?
I would say it is, I agree it is difficult. I definitely would call it a thriller, but I could see where it, of course, literary is a tough thing to draw, to define, but in my definition, it really does lean towards the literary.
Well, I agree with that, to be honest. And so I try to play that up or market it that way, but it's just difficult because the publishing world, and they just want things to be very cut and dry and very easy for them. They don't have to think about this is the shelf it goes on. But fortunately, I have a really good agent who loves my work. I mean, he just thinks it's great, and he's getting me out there and selling my books when I finish them. So I'm happy about that.
Do you see any of the other crime genres in the future possible?
Crime genre?
Yeah, mystery or suspense.
Well,
maybe a cozy.
No, not a cozy. I couldn't do a cozy.
Do a thriller cozy. Nobody's done that as far as I know.
Yeah, no, I used to read Agatha Christie kind of stuff, and I liked it very much, but it's not my style to do it that way. I was going to tell you why I turned to writing. I think you asked that, and we were going to get back to it.
Yeah.
Because I was in the midst of a career that, you know, I was making good money. I mean, I wasn't a rich man, but I was definitely fine, and I enjoyed my work. I never actually had a job I didn't really like, despite all the many jobs that lasted for different contractual reasons for a few weeks or a couple of years. It just would depend on what it was. I ended up being what they called the chief of party, which is not like a booze-driven party, but really the manager of a project. And I was the manager of the first U.S. government project to help Palestinians at the start of the peace process. And I designed the project. I was working for a consulting company. We won the project, which was a complete redesign of it from what the U.S. government had put out as an RFP, a request for proposals. And then I moved to Jerusalem with a multimillion-dollar budget to run this project. And I was working. I had 7 project offices around the occupied territories. I will tell you that my background, and I've said this often publicly, so it's not a big deal. I'm not Jewish, but I grew up a Zionist. I thought Israel could do absolutely no wrong, and I just always saw I'd go work on a kibbutz, and I never did that because other things came into play. But so here I am at the kind of what became the end of my career, formal career, running a major project to help Palestinians. So that was quite a personal arc and journey in my life. And it didn't so much change my view in terms of Israel, because what it did was open my view to the Palestinians. I want to put it that way. And my view became everybody has to be around the table or there is no peace process. And everybody has to be taken seriously or there is no peace process. So I decided that I had this wonderful awareness and these experiences that I could turn into a pretty interesting novel. And I intended to change the world and bring peace to the Middle East by informing the world of what was really going on over there. But from an objective perspective, my 4 main characters in the novel, Israeli war hero, an American journalist, a Palestinian farmer, and an Arab Christian grocer. And these reflect the main perspectives that are in play over there. There's not just a couple of perspectives, but 3 or 4. And I thought, well, I'm going to tell the world what it's really like. And I quit working to do that. And I'm still trying to sell books.
If one person got it, you did it right. And I find it interesting what you said, because to paraphrase what you said, you weren't anti-Israel, but you became pro-Palestinian.
I think that's a fair way to say it. Yeah, I mean, it just opened up another awareness of what really is going on and what's going to work and what's not going to work. And so it's really, the book is actually ultimately, this is A Vision of Angels, is actually a book about reconciliation. I edited a small piece out of that, which I called Stolen Memories. And if anybody wants to Google that and find that, it's 1,000 words long. And that piece itself was up for a Pushcart Prize. It's a beautiful piece. It really is based on my neighbor in Jerusalem, who was an older Jewish man whose family had been run out of Algeria at the time of the War of Independence. And he was a man with two club feet and had quite a story to tell. And that's the story that I tell in Stolen Memories, which is an excerpt of about 1,000 words. But it's out there if you search for it, or you can find it on my webpage.
It's on your blog. I read it last week and it was damn good.
Yes, on my blog.
Yeah, yeah. It was good. Yeah. So,
thank you. Yeah, yeah.
I agree with you. So I said I want to get back to this human trafficking, and I really want to do it now because I don't want to forget. Because,
oh, right, yeah.
Like I said, it's just awful. I don't use Fiverr. I don't know if you're familiar with Fiverr. It is freelance workers. And so if I want somebody to edit my podcast, I can hire somebody off Fiverr. They could be anywhere in the world. If I wanted somebody to type something up for me, just work as my secretary, or if I, you know, pretty much any job you can think of is on this Fiverr. Okay. Because it's really cheap. Some of them are so cheap, it's ridiculous. And there have been accusations that the reason that is the people on the other side are part of human trafficking. And I don't use Fiverr for that reason. And it's not because of the accusation, because I don't know whether that's true. But Fiverr has refused to look into the allegations. And I find it so disturbing. I can't believe they're not looking into it. So that just kind of gives you my feeling on the whole thing. And what I want to know is, because you've written about it and you write so much of your own experiences, you did experience it, or in one way or another. What was that? I want to know the situation and the scene.
Well, I'll tell you how I really came up with that novel. I have friends who are Africanists. I don't know how else to say. They specialize in Africa. They work for the State Department. They have worked in Africa the same way I've worked around in different parts of the world, very close to people. And they knew that I wanted to take on social issues. And so I had been convinced to look at blood diamonds. And for your listeners who may not know what blood diamonds are, because they're not in the news anymore, the countries in West Africa that have diamonds, the battles are usually fought to control the diamond mines, because the diamonds can buy arms. So this perpetuates civil wars and brutality in West Africa. So I was prepared to write a novel about that. And I've never lived in Africa, but I've been around it a lot. I've done many projects there. So I felt that I could write with some sense of authenticity with Africa. So I wasn't worried about that. So I was driving down Highway 1 in Delaware 3 days before I'm supposed to get on the flight to Antwerp to go visit the Diamond District and begin my journey of learning about the diamond trade in the world, when on comes Neil Conan. This is back in August or September of 2003, I think. And he's interviewing Jody Cobb, who is the photographer for the first real exposition on human trafficking that's ever been publicized. It was basically an exposition on modern-day slavery. And it was such an amazing story to me that there were, at that time, 26 million people in the world who were trafficked. There were 700,000 people being trafficked across borders, or within their own borders, every year. There were 55,000 trafficked people in America. I mean, it's the only time I've ever pulled off the road to finish a story on a radio. I just could not believe my ears. I decided that I had to deal with the human trafficking issue. And when I went to Antwerp, which has the second largest port in Europe, I figured, well, there's got to be a trafficking situation here, because that's what port towns are about, right? So I contacted the FBI agent in Brussels, and I contacted a few other people, and I met with two women in two different rescue homes who had been trafficked. And I learned about the difference between what happened to them if they came from Eastern Europe and what happened to them if they came from Africa. And I decided that since I had wanted to set a story in Africa anyway, I was going to set my story in Africa. And that began my journey with Cooper's Promise. I had to come up with a character, and I had to do all the things I do. And I ended up putting the two things together, blood diamonds and human trafficking, all in one novel.
And you brought up human trafficking in the United States, which people don't think about nearly as much. It's usually women or children somewhere else.
Right.
Doing these slaves, acting as slaves. And I was surprised doing some research. I was working on a human trafficking novel, which is on the shelf right now. But in my research, the large amount of human trafficking that goes on in the United States, and it's not just women. And a story that really gripped me was some guys from Poland, I think they were New Jersey or New York, were taken south, drugged up. They were straight men, but were forced to have gay sex, or sex with gay men, I guess I should say. And their fear was, you would know more than I, it's so revolting in Poland to be gay, if I'm right, that they couldn't imagine calling home for help.
I can believe that.
That makes sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, I would have to know individual circumstances and how families have been and stuff. And I deal with attitudes about homosexuality that are really pretty disastrous in my novel, Fire on the Island, which deals with the same sort of shame and attitudes in Greece that also I think the Poles have as well. They are not happy societies when it comes to gay presence or gay people particularly. That may have changed a little bit. I don't know about, I've been back to Poland, but I haven't really pursued that particular topic. I think in Greece, it's questionable, but Greece does have modern television and people are being more and more exposed to it. So, and we go to an island every year where there's, well, it's actually the island that Sappho came from. And though that's not why, but there people there tend to be a little bit more open to the gay experience, to gay people. But inside families, I don't know, traditional Greek families are pretty conservative on this. It would be a very tough thing. I know a couple of stories, even from this village that I'm alluding to, that a young gay guy just can't stay in the village. He had to go to Athens. He has to leave because he can't really be himself at all. It's just not possible.
And that really surprises me. I told you before we discussed this that in my novels, there is a major character who is Greek. And he works in a restaurant with his grandmother, who's Greek, and she's very open to his relationship and that sort of thing. And to make sure I had the translations correct, somebody went to a Greek man and said, "Does Brad have the language right?"
Right.
They said he slammed it and became furious and said, "Never would Greek men accepted by their grandmother. It would not happen." So I had to find somebody else to do the translation for me because he was so furious he didn't want to even look at it. And that shocked the hell out of me. And I thought that was an oddity.
No, I'm not surprised by that, to be honest. Now, technology and globalization and more information around, you'll find people who, every place who's more accepting, but also people who are just as strong against homosexuality or gayness as they've always been. In Greece, the issue is, it's the whole issue of shame. It's just tremendous shame. In fact, shame can work in a positive way too, because up until probably the end of the 1970s, into the 1980s, where there were just more people of different varieties showing up in Greece and living there, there was no crime to talk of. There was nobody broke into stores and stuff because it would bring shame on your family. They didn't want to do that. You know, it was only when things got a little bit more globalized that certain notions became more possible, but shame has always been a driving force in the Greek society. And I've been going there since 1972. It's a long time.
That's all surprising to me. I've never been to Greece, but I didn't expect it to be that way at all.
Yeah. I think I've spent about 7 years of my life in Greece, honestly.
Back to the Fourth Courier. There is a story about that I absolutely love. And what that story is, the story in the novel is a Russian-made portable bomb.
Right.
And it's brought to the U.S., am I correct?
It's just disappeared.
Okay, but a Russian physicist made a portable bomb.
Right.
And to understand how that would work, you called the Department of Energy.
I did.
I want you to tell what happened when you did that.
I'm trying to remember what year that would have been, but it was in the mid-90s, I think. Could it be possible? Yeah. No, even a little bit later. I called up and I basically said to the person who answered the telephone at the Department of Energy that I was a writer and I was writing a book about a portable nuclear bomb, and I needed to know how a nuclear bomb was made, and could I talk to somebody there who could give me some basics? I did, and I was transferred two or three times, and I finally got to this guy who turned out to be kind of a young, intelligent, and very proud of the work he was doing, scientist at the Energy Department. And he suggested meeting for coffee at, I think it was Costas Coffee at Rockville, Maryland. It wasn't Starbucks, but I think it was Costas. In Rockville, Maryland, we recognized each other in line, and we started talking in line and got our coffees. And in line, even, we were talking about building a nuclear bomb, and he sat down with me and showed me diagrams of what went into basically a homemade nuclear bomb. I'm thinking, how could this even be possible? You know, but it was before 9/11. So after that, things really got shut down, I think, for that kind of access.
Even if you wrote a book before 9/11, you put that in there, people would close the book and just say, I can't read anymore. It's too absurd.
No, I know. It's crazy. It's true, though. It's absolutely true.
So you're sitting there, and he pulled out the schematics in the coffee house right on the table for you to look at.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
No, it's true. And also, this is where access has changed. So also, I knew a guy. I don't want to tell his name or what his position was when I knew him, because I don't want to give that away. But he eventually became an assistant to Janet Reno, who was FBI director. And about the same time as I was first doing my first FBI character, and I wanted to learn more about the FBI. And so this guy arranged for me to have a private tour of the Quantico training facilities for the FBI. I mean, it was just me and an FBI agent. And can you imagine that happening now?
No, absolutely not.
No, I know, it's absolutely not. No, in fact, I'll say it wasn't just me. It's just not me and the FBI agent. My partner is a photographer, and he asked if he could come along, and I said yes. So there's actual evidence that this happened somewhere.
Wow. That's unreal.
Yeah, it's unreal, yeah.
Don't try to put that in a book. Well, it's interesting to me that when you talk about writing human rights violations, and that they are all in your book, but it's not like I'm reading a nonfiction novel.
Right.
It's just there.
Right.
And you get a taste for it, and you understand as best as you can what it would feel like, but you aren't given a lecture, and you do a really good job of that.
Yeah, I try to avoid hitting people over the head with a message. I mean, I don't like that either. And as soon as that happens in a book, I sense it, and it's like, no, this could have been done much more elegantly than just hitting them over the head with a message. I will say to your listeners that I believe that I've done a very credible job conveying the Greek perspective on homosexuality, Fire on the Island, and it plays a major role in terms of motivating and pushing the story along at the same time that it's not the central story. And so I think that if, for an example of how I handle things like that without being message driven, Fire on the Island is a good example of that. And I'm very proud of what I was able to actually accomplish in that novel. And the Greeks who have read it, they like the book. I mean, we don't talk about specific things all the time, but nobody's come to me and said, this simply isn't true. No, I think they all understand that what I've written is quite true, so quite accurate.
You remind me of another podcaster. He doesn't do a podcast on religion, but he makes it very clear that he is a Christian. He calls himself a God follower because he distances himself from a lot of things. And it was interesting because he said, evangelists out there are idiots. I think he even said those words. He said, nobody wants to have the Bible thumped over their head, which is kind of what I'm saying that you don't do, spoon feed it to them and it'll come across. I mean, obviously they're two different things, but I feel like that's what you're doing. You're teaching people something without them realizing that they're learning something.
Yeah, I aim for that. Thank you.
You do it well.
Thanks.
Given your life, have you considered a memoir?
I have. In fact, I'm really waiting to finish this new novel, which is really only a couple of weeks or a few weeks away from being ready to go out to my agent.
Actually, I need to stop you because given your background, do people read 400,000 word memoirs? Because I think that's how long it would take for yours.
I'm not going to write a memoir that goes from A to Z in my life, that kind
right,
of thing.
Right.
I couldn't possibly do that. And I would be bored to death, even though it would be my life. I'd be bored by even reading it. No, I'll be very honest. Many people have said to me over the years, I should write a memoir. I've had so many incredible experiences and just sort of put it out there on paper and let people read it. But I've never been inclined to do that until I read a book called How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by Alexander Chi, who is a Korean-American. And about 4 years ago, I'm going to say, the New York Times recommended this book of essays by Alexander Chi in its summer, in its list of summer reads, you know, the reading list of the summer. And I thought, you know, this sounds kind of interesting. I'm not usually interested in memoirs. I mean, I'm not, you know, just not. And I read it and I realized that what he was doing was taking significant events that were happening around him, like the Vietnam War or the AIDS crisis or things like that, AIDS epidemic, and using those as ways to talk about how they affected him and how he responded, as opposed to saying, well, then I went to this demonstration and then I did this and then I did that. It was a very elegantly written memoir in that sense to me. And it's like, yes, that's what I want to do. I want to write this memoir based on essays that tell my life, but don't tell it, basically deals with the issues that have concerned me and that have made me and how that all came about. So that's the memoir I'm going to write.
Two people that come to mind, one is Michael Nava and the other is Marshall Thornton. Michael Nava's books are all in the 80s. Marshall's one series takes place in the 80s and one place takes place in the 90s. Both of them write great stories. In the middle of the AIDS epidemic, the epidemic is in there, but again, it's not the focus of the story. And I can tell you, I was a sheltered young man in the South. So this whole AIDS thing was in the news and it was something happening like in the big cities. It wasn't where I was. I wasn't concerned. And to hear the stories or read the stories, fictional stories that draw me in because of the stories and the characters, but at the same time I'm getting a feel for what it was like that I could never understand is brilliant to me. Just brilliant. And I'd say that's very, very similar, if not equal to what you're doing about the causes that concern you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned earlier you haven't spent much time in Africa, but I know you know a lot about Ethiopia and the corporations there and how it's affecting their resources. So you obviously spent a little time there, but the big one is Tanzania.
Right.
And do you want to talk before I let you go about the Tanzania Trees and Water Project?
Well, sure. Yeah. I love the Tanzania Trees and Water Project.
I figured
Project.
You would want to.
A few years ago, I guess maybe 5 or 6 years ago, maybe seven now, I'm not exactly sure. My partner and I were in Tanzania on safari. We'd gone before a couple times. I'd been a little bit more often than he had been. And we just found our guide to be a terrific guy who started telling us about some of the community projects he was doing at his initiative in his village, which were pretty astounding. And one that really intrigued me was he's been convincing farmers to plant trees that have a 16-year life expectancy before they would be cut down and used as timber because it's a source of decent income. The numbers at the time where you buy a seedling for 50 cents and 16 years later you sell it for $200, $250. So that makes sense because there's almost no care to these trees. They just get planted and they grow. And this was really his idea for a retirement fund for the people in his village, that they would have these trees that they could cut down a couple a year and they would have a little steady source of income that was enough for them. And I just thought it was great. We both thought it was a great project. So I've always wanted to plant a lot of trees because I use a lot of paper And I tried to plant trees and had planted trees in Israel. I planted trees in Brazil. But the transaction costs were very high, and I really wanted to plant hundreds of trees. So I contacted these guys in Tanzania to say, you know, I want to plant like 300 trees or something like that. And they said, that's great, but actually what we really need is a well, because we've got two villages that have no access to actually water. They have to, everybody has to walk 2 or 3 miles each way every day to get as much water as they need. So if you want to plant trees, that's great, but we really could use help on a well project. So I said, okay, well, we'll just figure out we'll do both. So with some donations, and we built this well, and it's now serving two villages, and they're extending it to a third village. And this means it's helping maybe about 5,000 people total with water that they didn't have access to before. But the big project for me is really planting the trees. And every year we plant about 4,000 trees now. I've planted 16,080 trees in the last four years.
And here you wanted to start with a few hundred.
A few hundred, yeah. Now my goal is 30,000 trees in my lifetime. I'd love to be able to say I planted 30,000 trees in my life. This is an area that can absorb it. It's a deforested area. They're recreating habitat for animals. They're creating an income stream for them in the future, which is they're going to desperately need. And they're creating new crops because of it. The trees help shelter coffee plants like shade. So they're, you know, and Tanzania grows pretty good coffee. And the reason why these people weren't doing it on their own is that the time when you plant the trees is the same time you plant maize. And maize is the main staple of their diet. And they do not have the money to do both. So they can either plant maize and eat for the next year, or they can plant a tree and wait 16 years. So they just can't do both. So it's a good project in the sense that it's helping the environment, it's helping people, and it's sustainable. It could just keep going, because in the future, they're going to have, when they start harvesting these trees, you know, they're going to have enough money to replant the seedlings, which cost 50 cents versus $200. It's a good project. It's exciting.
Yeah, because if it was just the maize they're eating today, but there's going to come a point in their life.
Right, where they can't afford the maize.
Yeah, they have
no income.
No income.
These are very poor rural people.
It's amazing. It's so easy for us, for first world folk, to forget how something as simple as a tree can be so dramatic in somebody's life.
Yeah. Yep. You're right. Yeah. I'm glad. Yeah. And I'm glad we're doing it. It's great.
You are the Johnny Appleseed of the 21st century.
Well, I feel like Johnny Appleseed. I feel like Johnny Appleseed's grandfather, perhaps.
Well, what I'm going to do in the show notes, in addition to a link to your website, and I'm going to put a link to your Amazon author page, I'd also like to do a link to the Tanzania Tree and Water Project.
Okay.
Because people can make donations there, correct?
I'm going to have to go back and check exactly what's there right now. Yes, they can. I can sort that out very quickly. Yes.
Okay. Be generous, folks. You agreed to give some books away, and we're going to give away
The Fourth Courier.
The Fourth Courier. You can get it either in Kindle or hardback. And I'm going to give away two of those. And there's two ways that you can get it. Go to Apple and do a review, because Apple is the main place people go to look for reviews. But if you don't have Apple, you can go on iTunes. And whatever you put on iTunes does transfer over to Apple. Or an even better way, because if you do the next one, you'll get two entries into the drawing. And what that is, when this show comes out, if you share it on social media, you'll get two things in the drawing. So whether you do the review or the social media or both, just make sure you take a snapshot and let me know. The social media ones, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, those are pretty easy. You can just send me a link. If you do a review, they can take up to a week. So just when you hit enter, take a picture of what you just typed, because it's going to go away and not come back for a while. So get those to me, and I'll have a drawing for two of the hardbacks and two of the Kindles.
And just to express some promotion for that, The Fourth Courier, it's an interesting book at this time, because it takes place in Poland right at the time of the end of the Cold War. which was 1989 when Solidarity Government came into power. And basically it brought about the collapse of Russian influence throughout Eastern Europe, and which was one reason why I went to Ukraine three times, because it was during that period where I was being asked to do some consulting there. So it's an interesting book in terms of reflecting back on, in a way, what the Russians have done in the past and kind of how people came out of it, in a way that it's an interesting read for that reason. I think it's an historical piece at this point.
Okay, so don't do it just to get a free book. Do it because it's an important book. I haven't read that one, but I can assure you it's a good one.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Timothy. It's been great to have you back.
Yeah, thank you.
I enjoyed our conversation just like I did the last time, and I'm sure we could keep going. You've got so many stories that I do hope you write some memoirs one day and break them into pieces.
Thank you. Yep, I appreciate it, Brad. Thanks very much.